Namaste, everyone. All right, well coffeed up. So, what to reflect on? So, in the chanting of the metta chant, humble and not conceited, and then. By not holding to fixed views, a pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, is not born again into this world. That last line sounds pretty nihilistic, doesn't it? The end, no more, enough of this world, goodbye cruel world. You know, it can have that tone of nihilism in it. But the world in this sense is quite often referred to as the world of your perceptions and conceptions. So say, we live in a like, let's say, the recent report that it was the world's hottest month, right, or year, something. Every year it seems to be that. So that's the conventional world. It's very hot. But then the way we perceive and conceive of that now is very individual for each of us, right? So the, you know, the climate activists and the other groups and so on, everyone's world is actually different. It's the same temperature maybe, but the inner world of conceiving and perceiving is an individual world. And that's the way the Buddha would talk about the world. So in Buddhism, it's always helpful to remember there's a kind of teaching about conventional reality, and there's a teaching about looking at reality as a flow of events arising and ceasing in awareness or in consciousness or in the knowing. And both are important. So in the conventional, we call it conventional truth, there is the sense of me as a person, as an individual living with my responsibilities and my different karma and my national identity and my literate preferences and my tastes and aesthetics and my history and all of that. So that's individuality, and it's real. It certainly is real. And that's the world on a conventional sense. And then the other way of looking at the world is the arising and ceasing of perceptions and conceptions, coming and going according to conditions. And that's where that's the only time we really use the word anatta. We don't use the word anatta in our conventional sense, because it wouldn't make any sense, like that I'm not Viradhammo when I go to the airport. Good luck. You know, and the guy looks at my passport. Are you Viradhammo? No, I'm not Viradhammo. Okay, yeah, go over there. So it gets totally silly and so on. So if you don't understand that, Buddhism is very, very confusing. So it's not saying that the conventional realm is any lesser. One has to live skillfully in that. And of course, that's the realm of morality and social responsibility and political action and reading good books, or whatever you find is a good book. But this other way of looking at the world is also important, because that's where the lines like humble and not conceited begin to be more significant than the words are usually meant in a normal English context. So the word conceit is actually a very broad idea in this way of talking about Buddhism. It's not just the conceit of narcissism or arrogance, but it's the conceit of self-identity. So to say that I am better than you, I am worse than you, or we are equal is still a conceit. It's a conceit I am. Now on a conventional level, say, there are differences of talent and skill and so on. So let's say JC from Singapore makes fabulous spreadsheets, right? So he is better at making, I cannot make a spreadsheet. Big deal, right? So on a conventional level, JC is better than me at making spreadsheets. But on this other level of looking at things, if I take identity with my successes or failures. It's that kind of conceit of self which is problematic and causes suffering. And you can see by holding to fixed views that I am one way and you're, like, let's say just judgment of someone. Your judgment of them might be quite accurate in terms of the worldly dharmas, and you have to be conversant with that judgment. You have to use that judgment. But then to hold it as a viewpoint and then to indulge in aversion or arrogance or so on and so forth is obviously suffering in the world. So humility is more like that aspect of letting go of these endless self-identities, but living in a responsible way. That's very hard to do, isn't it? Because we so like the conceit that I am old. That's a conceit if I hold to it. And how would I hold to it? I say, oh, poor Viradamo, he's old. Give him more coffee. Or, I'd feel sorry for myself, or I'd whinge, or I'd complain, or I'd think I've got a fabulous body because I'm 73, or whatever it might be. It would still be a form of holding, an attachment. Whereas if there is the witnessing of the aging of the body as a function in nature, there's freedom there. And that's going to certainly come up when this body dies. And if I hold to the conceit that I am this body, okay, now what? Yeah. So, but if you don't hold the conceit that I am this body, and yet, so remember, you always these two levels you're working with. You still, the body needs to be taken care of, but not from vanity or conceit, just because body should be taken care of. The body needs to be clothed and fed and so on, but not from vanity and conceit. And then the conceit is always the sense of identity with this body, these emotions, whatever it might be. And that's where we also like Atavada and Sakaya Ditti and Bhava, all those ideas that you find in Pali Buddhism are around that limiting who I am to just this like bodily formation or these emotions. Whereas when you come to the sense of witnessing or knowing change, then you see that maybe your real home is not this body. You see that, can't you? You can feel uncomfortable, like the practicing with sickness is a very important part of liberation. And the idea that I'll never get sick is dumb, right? Or never get old is silly. So then when aging comes and you see people who don't have a reference of awareness and aging comes, then all the self-identities with aging, negative or whatever, come up and they're trapped into those self-identities, and it's tragic. But as this body ages and it gets sick, of course we don't hope that for anyone, but everyone has it, then you just witness like sickness is this way and you have refuge rather than identity. And yet on a conventional level you go to the doctor. It's so important to get those both operating. So then like humility itself, you could, it's an interesting word, isn't it? Humble and not conceit. It's probably not one that's much, I don't know, how much is that word used? Maybe it's considered to be a weak word now, I don't know. But all of us can reflect in different ways on it. But one way to reflect on it is that why should the world fulfill my desires? Why should the way the world operates accommodate the way I want it to operate? It's a pretty silly thought when you just take it that way. Why should the world be just? Well, it should be just, because that's right. Or why should the world be this or that? But it's not, it's this way. And then the conceit of desire, that my desires are really what's right in this world, and the world is wrong, is a pretty dumb way to approach things. On a conventional level, yeah, there are expectations. So if I live in a monastery, I have expectations, social expectations of the other community, and they have them of me. And those are the social contracts we have. And if someone does something outside of that contract, we say, no, you can't do that. So that's that level of social. But then at the inner level, if I want everyone to be harmonious all the time and agree with me, then that conceit by not holding to fixed views. I hold that view and I suffer. So, you know, I do my very best to bring harmony and try to be harmonious. I fail sometimes, I'm successful sometimes, but the most important thing is that I don't hold a fixed view of how it should be. It's this way, it's this way, it's this way, it's this way. And so there's this kind of humility of adaptation and yet responsibility in the conventions that I live by. You both are important. If you just take the one, the kind of flow of consciousness, it's just this way, it's anatta, then you could excuse all kinds of behavior. You know, the killing, well, it's, you know, there's no one there, it's not self. It gets really stupid that way. But if you only have the conventional realm of morality and ethics and social responsibility, if you only have that, that'll never be perfect either, no matter how hard you try. So you need both. You need both to operate together. So in that chant, when it says, by not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one having clarity of vision is not born again into this world, I would see that as born, this whole sense of egotistical birth as thought and as emotion into the world of this experience is not necessary. It's actually freeing not to do that. The other way of thinking about it is about rebirth and those kinds of thoughts. Well, you know, that can sound very nihilistic, can't it? Like, this world sucks and I'm out of here, never again, thank you very much, I've had enough. And that's not a very happy state of mind. Although sometimes we go there, you know, oh God, do I want to be a teenager again? No. So we think in those ways, but that's, I don't think, that's another kind of conceit. I am someone who was born and doesn't want to go through this trip again. Maybe there's validity in that, I don't know. But you don't want to have the conceit that I was born. Now that's pretty radical. The body was born, the body will die, but is that my real home? Is that my real identity? Or what am I? Who am I? And then you get to the idea of, again, you get to the idea of the Buddha's enlightenment. It's about the unborn, not the eternal. It's not like a guy called Viradamo living for eternity. That sounds boring, to say the least. But it's not about the personality and the body and that. It's about what is awareness? What is consciousness? And why is it always there? What's that about? So the reflective mind turns away from the changing experience, not out of rejection, but more out of curiosity. And the reason it goes out into the world of experiences is because desire. I want this, I don't want that. Natural enough, nothing wrong with that. But there comes a time, this sense of being tired of always going out into the objective world and actually turning back and say, what is awareness? What is consciousness? And that's not a question that can be explored through thought, because thought is still an object. And so then you see the necessity of silence for that exploration, the necessity of I would say intellectual humility, that to realize that you cannot contemplate silence through thought. So if the conceit is in thought and always figuring stuff out, you say, no, that can't be the way. Thought is still an object, thought is still contingent, thought is born and dies, it's conditioned. So you begin to let go of thinking. Not repress it, because we do that a lot. You know, you get so tired of the thinking mind, you just try to get rid of it. That's not it. It's more like, that can't be the avenue. It's a good avenue for solving problems in IT or in home economics or whatever, sure. But in this sense, no, it needs to be known as an object rather than being the driving force of a subject. That's the problem we face. So one of the things that Lompo Sumedho taught us way back was the noticing the cessation of thought, noticing how thought ends. Cessation itself is an important contemplative theme that you find throughout Buddhism, like the end of something, the end of an emotional turmoil. The end of a day, the end of a retreat, the end of thought, the end of self-thought. You know, these are the gaps within which rebirth takes place, the birth of the self, and to have enough acuity, attentiveness to notice a thought ceasing, and then not pick up another object, not go out into the objective experiences of mind, body, and abide as witness. This is a very skillful thing to do. You know, oh, this is the end of thought. But what happens is we are so, one of the habits of meditators is to notice that there is thinking and then try to force their attention on the meditation object in order to stop thinking. And then we've never really awoken to the whole feeling of no thought. And so there's a sense of me trying to do something to become something. Whereas if you can create the intention to notice the end of thought, just create that suggestion into the mind constantly, where's the end of thought? And you can play with that. You can say, I am Viradhammo. And wait. And all you find is consciousness of sense experience, but I am not Viradhammo. And it's actually the same silence, right? I am fabulous. I am an old fuddy-duddy. Fuddy-duddy. Right? It's just thought. And yet, when it's driven by emotion, it can seem very like this is reality. And this kind of fixed view of who I am. What is a fuddy-duddy anyway? to actually notice, like something very emotionally believable, maybe, like that, maybe around guilt or something like that, you know, there was a really interesting exchange that Lompo Sumedho had with this woman in Hampstead, and this way back, and I was sitting with Lompo, and this woman phoned up, she said, Lompo, I have to speak with you. We didn't have many, not many people knew we were in London, so it was kind of, okay, sure. So this lady came and says, I'm a horrible person. And Lompo said, well, what have you done? And she said, well, my daughter just had a child. Yeah, okay. And she showed me the child when I went to visit her, and I wanted to poke the child's eyes out. And I ran away. And now I'm horrible. And Lompo said, well, did you do it? And she said, no. So what's the problem? But she had taken the fixed view that she was an eye poker outer, granny, not like the grannies we have here, and you know, that she was hell incarnate or the devil incarnate. And that's like whole, I mean, it's an extreme example of that, but she was just mortified by this. And Lompo said, well, you didn't do it. You know, it's just some weird thing. Oh. And all of a sudden she could see it. She could see that. Huh? And that's a kind of extreme thing. So anyway, if you have like some feeling of, you know, some memory comes up and guilt comes up or something, then make it conscious. Maybe say it. Yeah, I'm Jack the Ripper. Or whatever extreme you want. And it's just know that. Oh, what's that feel like? And you see, there is no essence there. It's an emotional feeling driving thought. And that brings you to the end of thought and the end of that kind of selfing, right? The whole self-narrative. So you start to interrupt. You actually use the obsessions of thought to make yourself more mindful. So your mind is caught up with, like, let's say, some kind of guilt. And then you notice this guilt. And they actually say it. I am terrible. And then stop. Don't keep going, but you actually stop and then notice, it's like this now. You see, so you use the obsessive thought to propel yourself back into the present moment, rather than this tendency to always struggle and try to get rid of it and you know, this getting back to the meditation object. And then you become much better at noticing the end of thought. And then as you notice the end of thought, you notice that the personality is a thought. Right? This kind of personality view is a thought, and then it ceases. And there's just knowing, there's consciousness, and there's change. And so the reference becomes more and more on the knowing or consciousness or awareness, whatever you want to call it, that, you know, that's always present. So that has to be the gateway to the unconditioned. That must be, right? It can't be any condition out there. So by not holding to fixed views, you know, that, and humility and not conceit, it has a very deep, deep meaning in Buddhist texts and in the existential problems we face as human beings. Okay, let's do some meditation with those thoughts in mind. When you start to feel restless, and then you start to look at the clock and wonder when will the sitting be over, that's the sense of birth of self that we talk about. So you feel uncomfortable, and then there's the desire to get out of the discomfort. Then there's the idea of time. I have to sit for another 20 minutes. Should I go? Should I not go? So the whole sense of self arises as thought. And you can notice that. You can notice that as an object. And you can say something. You say, how much longer do I want to sit? And then stop. So you make conscious the restlessness. If that occurs. So anyway, if you kind of go back to these ideas of that the flow of consciousness is in awareness. So listen to sound. Notice it changing. And just taste the flavor of stillness. Stillness knowing, or knowing stillness. So that's not something you're trying to get, it's something you're noticing. And then feel some part of the body, feel your hands. And the feelings in the hands are in awareness. So consciousness, awareness, knowing, this is the constant. And the objects, sights, sounds, memories, thoughts, are the changing. And the desire wants to go out and change the objects, or gets caught up with the objects, usually through thought, memory. And then we learn to witness objects as changing and begin to reflect on that silence. So as Lopo Sumedho would say, be the knowing. And then once you understand that principle, you can choose an object of meditation to sustain knowing the way things are.